From Radio Sausalito in beautiful Sausalito, California, I'm Mitchell Field, and you are on the field trip. Welcome to The Field Trip, a few minutes of conversation each week with some of the most interesting people in the Bay Area and Marin County. I talk to artists and writers, actors, directors, musicians, some of the characters who make the Bay Area a fun and a fabulous place to live. So let's get right to it. This week my interview is the second part of my chat with John A. Martini, whose new book, Sutro's Glass Palace, has just been published by Hole in the Head Press. It's about the Sutro Baths.
If you want to go swimming, which was the big attraction, more stairs into the locker rooms where you changed. You put on one of Sutro's bathing suits. Nobody owned their own bathing suit, so you put on one of those big wool things with men's and women's both had skirts on them, and it had Sutro baths stenciled across it in big letters, I guess, so you wouldn't walk away with it, although it would have been great for the advertising. Finally, to the swimming pools, which were located, I measured, it was 100 feet lower elevation than where you entered the Sutro Baths. So aside from staircases in every direction, there was even an elevator. So in a sense, it was accessible. Although I don't think you'd call it ADA accessible in today's terms. The swimming pools, there were 7 of them. 6 were salt water, and they were heated to different temperatures. The warmest one was maybe 85, 90 degrees. The coldest one was whatever the ocean waves were that day, because they were taking wave water, breaking onto an artificial catch basin out on Point Lobos, and tunneling it into the baths. It was heated in the powerhouse, and the hottest one was frequently reserved for women and children. And then the others were varying temperatures. One, a small one all by itself, there was a spring, a freshwater spring, and this was one freshwater oval tank, and it was apparently just above freezing. And, you know, kids being kids, one of the challenges was to get into the hottest pool you could, swim around in there for a while, and then on a dare, run and dive into the ice-cold tank.
Sure.
You know, see if your heart keeps going. One of the oddities I turned up when doing the research was that they didn't bother to launder these suits when they were done, because the detergents in those days would have, you know, worn out the wool. So what they did after you turn the suit in was they rinsed them in boiling hot salt water, and then they hung them in a superheated dry room until they dried out. So they was sort of 19th century sanitation.
Well, I know the bathing suits, you mentioned they had little skirts. I guess that was for modesty's sake, right?
Yeah, it was definitely for modesty's sake. The men's and the women's, but the only difference was that the men's didn't have sleeves, whereas the women's had sleeves.
Sleeves, too.
Yeah.
And I know they had a little pocket in them, right?
Yeah. When you went to the swimming, to the changing room, they had a locker room attendant. He held the keys, so he'd let you to your little, you know, I'll call it a walk-in closet, changing room. And you changed your clothes, you left your clothes and your valuables in the room, and the attendant locked the room behind you. And he gave you a little circular metal tag with the number of the locker room on it, and either wore it around your neck like a medal, or put it in a little pocket that was sewn into the bathing suit. And then when you got out, you know, you're dripping wet, you had to track down the locker room attendant, give him the tag, and put you back in your room. Those little tags are very collectible. I've only seen about 3 or 4 of them.
Well, as you said, swimming wasn't the only attraction of the baths, right, John? They had entertainment and vaudeville acts and trick diving things. Tell us who Professor Carl was.
He was the one that had the Monte Carlo Drowning Act. The Monte Carlo Drowning Act was an act where literally he would pretend to drown. He was actually a very good swimmer, and for demonstrations, he'd swim from Sutro Bath out around Seal Rocks and back again, as, you know, just to show an endurance swimmer in ocean water. But the drowning act is very popular. He would dive into a pool with wearing a pair of handcuffs, and he would disappear underwater. And he would be down seemingly forever. And after about 3-4 minutes, the crowd would start to get really upset. And after about 5 minutes, you know, women are screaming, you know, save the poor man, he's drowning, somebody get him out of there. And after, you know, time that would, you know, any other person would have died, he would, you know, come to the surface, minus the handcuffs, gasping, and the crowd would, you know, just, you know, roar its approval. It turns out there was a trick. He had an upside-down tub at the bottom of the tank, and it was just painted the same color as the bottom of the swimming pool. And he would dive in, and he would just, you know, stick his head up underneath this, basically an inverted wash tub for 3 or 4 minutes, and then he would, you know, reappear magically at the surface. And the Monte Carlo Drowning Act was very efficient until one day he drowned.
Oh, my goodness.
It was, luckily, it wasn't at Sutro Baths. It was, I think, up in Sacramento. But the air had gone stale inside the inverted tub. It was a place where he'd never done the act before. And he drowned while he was underneath there. And you know, the lifesavers, you know, pulled his body out. And the audience thought it was part of the act. They were applauding and cheering. And not a very pleasant end.
My goodness, that's terrible. There was a Professor Baker.
Yep. Everybody was a professor. Jack the Diving Dog was popular, and he was a trained dog, and he'd go off the high dive boards, and the highest board was about 30 feet above the water. But what's unrecorded is whether or not somebody had to nudge him off the edge or whether he willingly made it by that.
Well, now, one of the things they had was a walking underwater contest.
Yes, they had a walking underwater where you, according to the article, they gave you 2 50-pound dumbbells, which is a huge weight, and you got into the pool at the deep end, and you were to walk to the shallow end. And you know, whoever made it all the way to the shallow end without having to drop the dumbbells and come up for air won. You know, maybe it was a $5 prize, which was, you know, pretty good in those days. They had another one that was swimming underwater, and the contestants had to wolf 6 donuts in a row, and then dive into the water.
Well, on a more serious topic, tell us about the California state legislature's bill from 1897 called the Dibble Bill. What was that, and how did it relate to Sutro Baths?
The Dibble Bill was an early bill, an early civil rights bill. It passed the California legislature that mandated that people of color could not be prohibited from using public bathing accommodations and barber shops and some other facilities. And it was put into action very quickly by a young man who went to Sutro Baths, an African-American who wanted to see if the bill had teeth. So Sutro Baths was segregated. African-Americans and Asians were allowed inside the baths, but not swimming, because people wouldn't go swimming with minorities. It was the 1890s. And he somehow got himself not just a ticket to admission, but the second ticket, which was to get a swimsuit and a towel and admission to the swimming tanks. And when he got down to the locker room attendant said, no, you know, I thought that we don't let colored people into the pools. And he sued. The young man sued Adolph Sutro, and it went to the courts, and it was something of a pyrrhic victory because the young man won his lawsuit against Adolph Sutro, but he was awarded only $100, and the amount of his award was less than the court costs. And in those days, if your award in a lawsuit is less than the court costs, you have to pay the court costs. So basically, he came out on the short end of the stick, but with a pyrrhic victory.
Well, that wasn't the only brush that Sutro had with the courts. I know that he had a dispute with the Southern Pacific Railroad while he was running for mayor of San Francisco, and this whole thing held up the opening of the baths, right?
Yeah. Adolph Sutro, he had underwritten the construction of a little steam railroad that ran all the way from Presidio Avenue out through the wilds of the now Richmond District, which that time was sand dunes, out to Sutro Heights. And he had underwritten the construction of what was called the Ferries and Cliffhouse Railroad on the condition that transfers be given to the passengers. There was no muni in those days. It was all competing street railroads running all over San Francisco. And Sutro wanted to make sure that transfers were given so it was as cheap as possible to get out to his attractions. And a few years after the railroad went into service, it was bought by the Southern Pacific Railroad, which was the biggest and most hated monopoly in California. It was called the Octopus. And the Southern Pacific Railroad, you know, voided the transfer policy. And essentially, the cost of a car fare to get from anywhere in San Francisco to Sutro Baths doubled from a nickel to 10 cents. And that would have been a huge imposition on people coming out. It would have dropped visitation at Sutro's Baths. And Sutro was a populist. He really did. You always think he was doing something for the little guy. So this just hacked him off. The baths were just about ready to open. And Sutro announced that unless the Southern Pacific Railroad, you know, gave back the transfer policy and the fare went back to a nickel, he wasn't going to allow the baths to open. And he stuck to it. Although there was an opening ceremony and people were allowed to walk around the museums and listen to music, there was no swimming at Sutro Baths for a year and a half. Sutro basically held it ransom. Several months later, Southern Pacific Railroad relented and they dropped the fare. Sutro won the battle. But Sutro held off on actually letting people swim on the baths, which was, you know, the big hook that he was hanging out there for his own reasons, one of which was he had more things in mind aside from Sutro Baths. He wanted to have a grand opening of basically his empire. And in 1896, in March, he opened the baths to swimming. The same month, he simultaneously opened the lavish new cliff house, the one that only exists in photographs, the huge Victorian cliff house. And he opened the rides on Merry Way at the amusement park. And he opened his own new electric railroad to compete with the steam train with a fare of a nickel. So finally in 1896, the baths were totally open. And ta-da, you could go swimming and everything else. And apparently that weekend it rained like mad. And so it was very anticlimactic. The crowds were small, and it was, aside from the fact that now you could get in the water and swim, it was still Sutro's. So he fought lots of little battles like that. And the funny thing is he loved these battles. They were all political in nature. At the bottom of nearly everything was, you know, San Francisco politics.
And his battle with the Southern Pacific did actually really help him become the mayor of San Francisco for a term, right?
Yeah, that also entered into it. He operated on many levels. He was a philanthropist, he was a book buyer, he was a wheeler dealer, and he loved politics. He'd tried to get elected senator from Nevada. That never happened. He decided to run for mayor of San Francisco, and he won. One of the reasons for his war with Southern Pacific, as I mentioned, he was a populist, and he ran for mayor and was elected on the populist ticket. And part of the reason that he was popular with the people was because he was taking on Southern Pacific Railroad.
Right.
Just like in San Francisco, you know, today, you can get a whole lot of votes by taking on, you know, big oil or you know, big tech.
Sure.
You know, so they, yeah. So Sutro, although he's the kind of guy that, you know, asks for a pony for Christmas and then gets it and really doesn't like it when he finds out, you know, what it's like taking care of a pony. He got elected mayor, and he immediately ran into the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. The mayor does not have unlimited power. You got to go through the Board of Supervisors. He served one two-year term and finished and said, that's it, I'm not running again. So a newspaper reporter asked him what he'd accomplished as mayor, and he said nothing. He said he was used to you know, working with hard rock miners and unions, but he could not control politicians.
Well, that's more fascinating stuff about Sutro Baths from historian John Martini. His book, of course, is called Sutro's Glass Palace. It's published by holeintheheadpress.com. Let's make that part two of our interview with John, and we'll hear some more from him next week. In the meantime, if you want to find out more about John, go to johnamartini.com. Well, thanks for joining me on the field trip today. I welcome your views and comments on the show, as well as your suggestions for future guests. My email address is mitchellfield@radiosausalito.org. The theme music you hear behind me is the tune Superjet, with the fabulous Marin sax man Noel Jukes up front. It's from the recording The Noel Jukes Quartet, featuring Matt Clark. Please remember that the field trip can be heard Wednesdays at the top of every hour at 1610 on your AM radio dial in Southern Marin, countywide on Wednesdays at noon on cable channel 26, anytime on your computer at RadioSausalito.org and 24 hours a day as a free podcast from the iTunes Store. If you liked today's show, please tell your friends. And if you didn't, well, please tell your enemies. So till next time, this is Mitchell Field saying goodbye, good luck, and see you next week.